We're exploring decentralized finance, the world of alternative financial services here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Glad you could be here. Decentralized finance, or DeFi as it's called, businesses operating in the cryptocurrency realm that have moved into areas that once belonged to traditional banks, like lending and borrowing. So a user with a crypto wallet can do stuff like trade digital cryptocurrencies, get loans, do other monetary-like things. Do you collect Bitcoin or do you appreciate other cryptocurrencies? What is it about digital cash that worries you or confuses you? 800-642-1234 to join in. Hillary Allen is a law professor at American University Washington College of Law, focusing on financial stability regulation. Hillary, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Kate. Good morning.
Good morning. Give us a much fuller picture, if you will, of what DeFi is about, how it fits into the cryptocurrency ecosystem.
Sure. So people are starting to get used to things like Bitcoin, which is a type of crypto. But it's difficult to use Bitcoin for the types of transactions you just mentioned, like lending and things like that, because its price bounces up and down so much. So we're starting to see the evolution of things called stable coins, which are coins that have their value pegged to the US dollar or some other currency. And so the idea is that they will keep a more stable value and that then they can then provide sort of virtual versions of the transactions that you would normally obtain from a bank, like the loans that you mentioned earlier. And that all happens using computer programs that execute themselves, that kind of thing.
Okay. And you recently testified before the U.S. Senate Banking Committee about this, as they explored stable coins. What did you tell them?
A lot of things I'm worried about is what I told them. So the thing about these stable coins is that they purport to be stable. They say, you know, having one of these stable coins is the same as having a U.S. dollar. Except that they're not U.S. dollars. They're not issued by the U.S. government. They're backed by, you know, what they say is a reserve of collateral, but it's sometimes hard to figure out exactly what's in that reserve because we don't have great disclosures. And so it's not clear that these stable coins are actually as stable as they purport to be. And it's also a little worrisome how they're being used. So they're being used in this DeFi system where I said that they're being used to provide sort of simulacrums of regular financial services. But there's a lot of fragilities in that market and a lot of scams that are happening in that market. And I think that should make all of us a little nervous.
So a little bit more, context here. Are these decentralized? There are also these decentralized apps or dApps. How do they fit into the picture of this whole system of DeFi?
Well, the idea about dApps goes back to the point I was talking about, sort of self-executing. This idea that, you know, these transactions can happen without people pushing buttons, without a human being having to sort of process the transaction. And when everything is working well, that seems pretty appealing, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's efficient. Maybe you don't have costs. Maybe you don't have any conflicts of interest, people looking for kickbacks. But I think what it does is it hides some of the conflicts of interest that may migrate from the program to the programmers of the dApps rather than the people executing them. And it also makes this whole system more fragile. We all know that things can go wrong. And when something goes wrong, it's nice to have a human you can call, even if you have to wait on hold for a long time, to say, you know, how do I fix this? Well, when it's a computer program that's executed, who do you call? It's not always clear. And so I think it's a challenge for consumers if things go wrong in this environment.
Hillary Allen with us, professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, specializing in financial stability regulation, explaining DeFi, decentralized finance, and taking your questions, 800-642-1234. Gwen is joining us from Whitewater. Hi, Gwen. What's on your mind about cryptocurrency?
Hi. I'm a high school student about to go into college, and I'm really concerned about how cryptocurrency can affect small businesses and our economy at whole, even if it's just like not necessarily related to the regular economy. And I'm concerned that maybe because so many young people invest in cryptocurrencies instead of investing in small businesses in real life in their local communities, how can that affect the economy?
That's really interesting, Gwen. Hillary, what do you make of that?
Well, I really appreciate the question, Gwen. In fact, it's something I'm so worried about that I wrote a whole book about it called Driverless Finance. So, you know, we've been talking so far about problems for individual consumers using these services, but you've put your finger on a really important issue, which is at what point does all of this get so big that it can blow up and infect the rest of the economy, even for people who've never even, you know, touched a crypto asset themselves. So it gets complicated. There's a lot of chains in which I think this can sort of infect our broader economy. And as I said, I wrote a whole book about it because, you know, envisaging the streams, the interconnections can get complicated, but they are very much there. And it is something we should all be thinking about.
Well, DeFi supporters will tell you this is the way money is democratized, that it will open up basic banking services to everyone. What do you see as potential benefits and downsides to that thinking?
I have to say I'm very skeptical of that whole line of reasoning. The idea that money will ever be and financial transactions will ever occur without any intermediaries getting in there to make money from it just seems unrealistic to me. You know, there's economic reasons why I mentioned earlier, you want someone to call when something goes wrong. So you want an intermediary you can contact. And then there's just human nature, right? If there's money to be made in this system, you can't tell me that intermediaries won't proliferate. So I think we are going to have intermediaries in the system. And so you have to ask yourself, do you want those intermediaries to be ones that we know and we may not love, but at least we have some idea of what they do and they're regulated? Or do you want those intermediaries to be people that are shadowy, that we have no experience with, and that are avoiding a lot of the regulation by operating in a shady cyberspace? I mean, to me, that's an easy question. I think the promise of a completely decentralized finance is illusory.
The Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions put out an advisory warning about DeFi recently, saying that it lacks many protections that you've been talking about offered that, you know, by regulated service providers. What are the traditional banks' position here? What are they seeing in this area?
It's an interesting question, and I don't think there's one single position that the traditional banks are taking. So, you know, JP Morgan, for example, is quite interested in what's happening in the DeFi space and is looking to maybe enter it. So this goes back to my point about decentralized finance not being quite so decentralized. If there's money to be made, even our established intermediaries want to get in on that. So there are banks that want to get into this space. And then I think there are others that see it as competition. But more than anything, I'm sort of seeing interest in exploring the space for themselves and profiting there.
We're discussing a slice of the crypto industry called DeFi, for short, decentralized finance, with American University Law Professor Hillary Allen is here. What would it take for you to regularly use a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin? Do you worry, like Gwen does, what it would mean for our local communities? Would you ever invest in a crypto? Are traditional banks behind the curve on this? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Hillary Allen here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the future of decentralized financial systems, how it works with cryptocurrencies. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. DeFi Pulse is the leaderboard for decentralized finance. It's a benchmark charting the growth and activities of some decentralized apps or dApps and the collateral for these smart contracts that we haven't talked about, but that's topping $93 billion at the moment. So what questions do you have about what DeFi users can do? Do you think buzz about DeFi is overblown, or is it the leading edge of financial services? 800-642-1234. Hillary Allen is a banking and financial law professor at American University with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's go to, well, Jason in Duluth wanted to, is no longer here with us, but wanted to bring up climate and the effects on our environment. And I was looking at this Columbia study recently, Hillary, just looking at the energy that is involved with digital mining and the implications on climate change. Can you kind of connect the dots there for us?
Sure. So there are many different cryptocurrencies that have many different ways of verifying their transactions. And if they use a way of verifying that's known as proof of work, that's when all this mining's involved. And so essentially, that's just a lot of computer servers running at very high speed, essentially trying to guess a number. And it takes an enormous amount of computing power. And it is very, very environmentally damaging. And so I think we have to be asking ourselves, when people are using this proof of work, when they're doing this mining, what does society actually get that makes up for that environmental damage? And I've yet to hear a convincing answer on that.
Okay, and so the Ethereum is looking to reduce its energy use by, it said, 99.9% this year by transitioning to a system called proof of stake. So that doesn't require computational power, apparently. What's going on there?
That's right. So proof of stake is a way of solving the proof of work problem, environmental impacts that we just talked about. It's generated a lot of bad press for the crypto industry, understandably. And so they're looking at proof of stake as an alternative. So this is sort of another way of trying to verify transactions without requiring trust in one particular institution or node as being the verifier. It makes things more complicated. I mean, so all of this decentralized stuff makes things more complicated. And it's actually a reason why a lot of these crypto services have struggled to scale up. So just in terms of volume, you know, they process nothing like what a Visa or a MasterCard is able of processing in terms of volume of transactions, simply because they go through these complicated verification processes, be proof of work or proof of stake. So the question is, does proof of stake work at scale? And that's something we need to see.
So globally, Bitcoin's power consumption at the moment could be really bad. It could have pretty bad implications for climate change. How do cryptocurrencies then become more sustainable?
They have to shift away from proof of work. I don't see a way in which proof of work is compatible with our very urgent need to respond to climate change.
Looking at regulation, the Financial Action Task Force that makes this anti-money laundering rules for governments around the world, what is its stance on DeFi? Like, who is looking at this?
So Financial Action Task Force is sort of a global body that looks at money laundering. So that kind of work in the United States is primarily carried out by a body called FinCEN, which is our financial intelligence unit. And they're looking at this very closely because there is, not just FinCEN, also OFAC that looks at sanctions, because there is a lot of illegal activity that's being financed with crypto and is exploring the DeFi market for applications there.
Is their work transparent? I mean, how do we know if they're working at very closely? Are there things that the average consumer should know if they want to get into cryptocurrencies?
Yeah. So, I mean, the OFAC and FinCEN do issue reports regularly that talk about the amount of sort of illegal activity happening. But I think for the everyday consumer, you're less concerned about what I'd say is like money laundering and more concerned about being scammed, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they've come up with a whole new name for a whole new genre of scams called rug pulls, which are proliferating within the DeFi ecosystem. And it's called a rug pull because it's like having the rug pulled out from underneath you, right? You put your money, usually a stable coin, maybe a Bitcoin, into a DeFi app. and you can't get it out again. Either it's exchanged for worthless tokens, or there's a problem in the computer code that doesn't let you withdraw your money again. And so you're stuck. And the rug has been pulled from underneath you. And that's something that people should be very careful about. I was just going to say, you can't really detect these unless you have a sophisticated knowledge of computer programming, which I certainly don't.
As we were looking through it, all of this complex jargon, we didn't stop at smart contracts. What is the role of smart contracts in this area?
Yeah, we didn't name smart contracts, but we kind of talked about them a little bit. This is the idea of your getting the intermediary out of it, or at least theoretically, by having a computer program that executes itself.
Okay.
Right? So that's all a smart contract is it's a computer, it's not really a contract, it's a computer program that's designed to self-execute instructions about a financial asset without any human pushing the buttons.
In a matter of seconds, though. I mean, this transaction can happen in 15 seconds.
Yeah, and sometimes even less. And so going back to Gwen's comment about how could this impact our society more broadly, when things are going well, fast, efficient, you know, speedy contracting is great. But when you're in a financial meltdown, we need pauses. We need time to reflect. We need to see what needs to be done. We need to think about what the spillover effects could be. And these smart contracts, because of their speed of execution, they get rid of that ability to pause to a large degree. And that's something that really worries me about the rest of the economy suffering if this DeFi really takes over.
Hillary Allen with us, professor of law at American University Washington College of Law, as we look at decentralized finance, what it means and how it works within the cryptocurrency ecosystem. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Hillary, what does this mean for the person who is banked at a traditional bank and is doing their borrowing and their car note, if you will, all of the traditional ways? You know, they have a couple credit cards in their wallet. Where do you go from here with that average person in the whole monetary system?
Well, I hope that person can continue going on as they've been going on. Banking itself, traditional banking, certainly isn't perfect. I'd like to see more consumer protections built into there. But hopefully that person can keep on doing just what they've always been doing. And hopefully we can avoid the situation that Gwen identified, where things that happen in crypto would spill over and hurt those people.
Where do you see the need for consumer protections that need to be built into cryptocurrencies as people buy and sell?
The most obvious consumer protection for crypto is disclosure. For example, you know, people often don't even know what's backing the stable coins we talked about earlier. But I don't think disclosure can do all the work, right? Disclosure is already hard for most people to understand financial disclosures. Now, suddenly we're expecting people to understand the computer code of what they're dealing with. I think that's just too heavy a lift. So maybe we need to go beyond disclosure to thinking a little more broadly about whether certain things should just be banned.
And this whole financial system, too, is dependent on energy as we go back to climate change. I mean, it's dependent on electricity to keep these massive computers running. And so that is a risk as well, because what if the energy goes away? What if the lights don't go on? What happens then?
That is definitely always a concern. That's a concern for regular banks as well. And so that's, you know, with climate change, we need to be thinking holistically about all of our financial services, whether they'll be able to continue being provided when the lights go out. And that's why I actually think it's vital that we keep using cash so that we have that alternative for natural disasters and things like that.
That is the first time the word cash has entered this conversation. What is the future of cash? Because we've also seen coin shortages in the pandemic.
Yeah, so it's an interesting one. There's plenty of people who are very interested in going to a cashless society. There are others who object, usually because, you know, there are large portions of our population who have no bank account, really. So that if, you know, if you get rid of cash, you exclude them from the economy. And I think that's a real concern. And then, as I said, there is the idea of, do we need a backstop in case all our electronic transacting goes down? You know, a coin shortage is real. It's not like this is a perfect solution that doesn't involve any logistics of its own. So we do need to start thinking through those issues as well.
Hillary, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Hillary Allen is a professor of law at American University Washington College of Law. She has a new book out analyzing the financial tech industry. It's called Driverless Finance. Ahead this hour, it's the annual report card examining the well-being of children in Wisconsin. We break it down with the director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Has your child struggled with social isolation, with stress, cyberbullying, learning loss? What issues are you most concerned about with the kids now? Join in 800-642-1234. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Just a heads up on our programming plans Monday. Join us here on the Ideas Network honoring Martin Luther King Jr. Day on Monday the 17th. It is a rebroadcast of the 2021 official Wisconsin celebration and tribute hosted by Dr. Jonathan Overby. That's Monday at noon. Find out more at WPR.org. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about the love of dogs and the snow.
Dog sledding has been a family affair for writer Julie Buckles. She and her husband Charlie Ray caught the bug when they first moved to northern Wisconsin. And she's raced with her daughter Caroline in the annual Apostle Islands dog sled race. But this weekend marks the first year the mother of two will be racing on her own. Danielle Kading brings us this audio postcard.
If you have dogs that are kind of snippy or have a bad attitude, it just takes all the fun out of it. So actually, everyone in this kennel has a great attitude. When we moved up here, we were introduced to the racing community through the first Apostle Island sled dog race. And we also had met John and Mary Thiel, who run Wolfsong Mushing. They do it as a business. And they had it was back when they had four dogs. They have 50 now. But when they had four dogs, they took us out, and we just thought that was super fun. And Charlie and I had done some big wilderness trips, and Charlie had this idea that if we had dogs, we could go out and do winter wilderness trips. And so for my birthday one year, he built me a dog box and said we were going to go fill it. I always thought dog sledding would end when my kids weren't interested anymore. And so Caroline had raced four races. And she had been so involved with the dogs, but she was 13 and she's got sports. She's in cross-country ski team. And she basically said, I'm done. Charlie and I agreed we were going to start selling, and he even started selling here on Craigslist. And he came to me to talk to me about what we should price it at, and I started to cry. And I'm like, I don't know if I'm ready to be done. A month or two later, Blair, who has a racing kennel, called me and said, I have this awesome dog named Popeye who just has a heart murmur, and so he can't do longer races. Are you interested? And I don't know, just that name Popeye, I was sucked in. Every musher has a story about how it started with one dog. Kind of my rebirth in dog sledding started with one dog, and it's Popeye. And he's the loudest one in the kennel. I usually get them out four times a week minimum. They really need to be exercised at least every other day. This is their prime time. It's cold. They're ready to go. They're part of our family because with this team, I almost never, ever give dogs away. Once they're here for life. I reached a point one year where we had a set of dogs that all died, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I can't say goodbye to any more dogs. But then a new dog comes along, and you fall in love again. And you just realize that that's part of the deal. Unbite, unbite, unbite. All right, hi, Peggy. It's really an awesome time because I think about one thing, and it's the dogs. Because dog sledding is a 0 to 50 sport. You could be trotting along 1 minute, and if you stop paying attention, you've gone to 50, and you've got a tangle, your team is loose. It's all consuming. And so when you're out, this is all you're thinking about. But then every once in a while, my mind does wander, and I think about things like, which dogs will get to run at the sled dog race? And I think it's these six. And then, or I might think about, like, if I had a new litter of sled dog pups, what theme would I choose to name them all? And it's just everything about these guys is so, so much fun. And just being out there with them is just, it's all about them. I don't think about bills or emails or what I have to do next. I just think about that run that day and how well it's going. And when it goes well, it's a really great day. Right, guys?
Danielle Kading is a reporter with the Superior Bureau of Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
And now to the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, which is out with its annual report on child well-being and its dashboard of indicators distilling Wisconsin data, showing where Wisconsin is trending in the right direction. Those are green lights, and where we're going in the wrong direction, red lights. And this comes as U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy issued a stark warning about the mental health of young people last month. Has your child struggled emotionally in these times? What have you done to try to help them? 800-642-1234. Linda Hall is director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. Linda, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning. It's good to be with you again. I appreciate your attention to this really important issue.
Absolutely. You know, we've heard the U.S. Surgeon General talking about this, health professionals sounding the alarm that children and adolescents are really struggling. Do these warnings match what you're seeing in Wisconsin data?
Yes, unfortunately, they do. The data in our 2021 report, which actually is data that's primarily before the pandemic, shows that our kids are struggling more with anxiety and depression, with difficulty making and maintaining relationships, and difficulty in feeling like they belong at school and in the community.
I was really troubled that the report's data shows it takes an average of 11 years before children get treatment and help for mental health issues. And that's a very long time compared to if you would have a physical ailment. What is going on there?
Well, I think there are a few things going on. First of all, most people know that we have a shortage of mental health professionals. So it means that access to professional mental health services is not readily available in most parts of the state. I think it's also that adults don't always recognize what's happening with kids. They're either not looking for the symptoms, or when they're seeing problem behaviors, they're assuming that it's something else, it's defiance, when really it's often about mental health. And the kids, through their behaviors, are trying to tell us something. So we've got a few things going on there. And then there's also the issue of stigma. That stigma is reducing a little bit, but it's still there. And that gets in the way, too.
I really like this. You have this one tip that I always think about, and you recommend that we spend 5 minutes every day checking in with our child to see how they're doing. And I'm thinking, you know, there's 24 hours in a day, and we're devoting 5 minutes to them and what's going on in their lives, nothing else. That doesn't seem like much. And yet, you know, how important is that 5 minutes? What's going on there?
Yeah, I've talked to several people, and that's what they're really advising. Take that 5 minutes, you know, maybe right before bedtime, you know, you're tucking your kid in, maybe you're even tucking in your teenager, and just, you know, leave 5 minutes there to just listen to what they have to say. no electronics in the way. You know, look them in the eyes and just listen to what they have to say. Open that line of communication, and you know, they may not talk to you a lot at first, but soon they will. And then you're going to know what's going on with them, and you're going to have a better idea of what you need to do as a parent to support them.
Really showing that they matter, that what's going on in their lives really matters, regardless of all of the noise and stresses that is either in that household or in the larger world.
Absolutely. And to understand what it is they are concerned about, not what you think they're concerned about, because you may be off target in terms of what's really on their minds. And I mentioned that the having no electronics, because we're hearing from the kids that we talk to that they are as concerned about their parents being on their phones too much as their parents are concerned about them being on their electronics. So it's got to be that face-to-face thing, because we know that even with older kids, that looking in the eyes makes a difference. It's like, I think a lot of people have heard about the importance of looking in an infant's eyes, that's important for the child's brain development, and it also helps the parent. Mm-hmm. What we're learning is that's also true for older kids. So have that conversation, keep that communication line open, so you know when it's time to step in and help your kid. And we also have on our website a map that helps parents think about when they're you know, how to decide if their child needs some more professional help, and then how to start the path of looking to find that professional help.
Let's bring on a caller. Jeremy is joining us from Racine. Hi, Jeremy. What would you like to bring up? Hi.
Hi. So I have raised an autistic son. He's now in his lower 20s, like 22 years old. And not only is it hard for parents to deal with him at home because you're still learning what exactly is wrong when you first have him, it took us about 4 or 5 years before we could finally start getting a pattern down where, okay, we can kind of narrow it down to what's going on. But the other fundamental issue that we always dealt with, which was a big factor in his life, was public schools and the public schools' inability to manage children with disabilities and mental health issues like autism, ADD, ADHD. Schools have labeled him as a behavioral disorder. Very common things, but basically the people that are managing these programs, you may have one or two for an entire school system that knows a little bit more of the backgrounds of these types of conditions, but generally the teachers that are with them day in, day out, they do not have the training. And it turns into a lot of dramatic situations that these kids go through school that carries on into their adulthood. My son still speaks of high school as if it was yesterday, and it's an ongoing issue with his development as an adult because he keeps remembering some of the bad experiences that he dealt with in the public schools and their inability to manage people with autism.
Jeremy, your story, thank you so much for sharing it and being open to share that. Linda, what would you say with what you're hearing from Jeremy's experience?
Well, Jeremy, you raised a really important issue, and our office has a practice of having people with lived experience of negotiating the mental health system active with us. We have a number of parents who have had children with autism or other mental health issues, and they are telling us the same things that you are telling us. So we know that mental health literacy, so the adults at school understanding mental health and having some tools in their toolkit to respond to these issues is really important. One of the things that we've been working on in cooperation with the Department of Public Instruction is a mental health literacy curriculum that is now available for free off the DPI website. And it offers instruction at all levels of school, from elementary to high school. We are also really promoting youth-led programs in the school to address these conversations, because youth are telling us Similar to what you're saying, youth are telling us there aren't enough people in the school who understand mental health and are comfortable talking about it. So we have a lot to do in terms of educating adults and then helping them with strategies on how to address behaviors, to understand behaviors. Again, to understand that with those behaviors, kids are often trying to tell us something. So understand the behaviors and then have a positive approach to how to work with kids on it.
And we're going to put a link up of the lived experience partners on your website and the form that you fill out. We're talking with Linda Hall, Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health, on her office's 2021 annual report, What the Social Disruptions Mean for Child Well-Being. Your thoughts, still time to talk if you're a teacher, a pediatrician, a social worker, a family therapist. What issues have you seen children grappling with? What have you recommended? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Linda Hall here in the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about children's mental health, a new state report on the well-being of young people in our state. U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy on CNN last month.
Many kids feel ashamed of their struggles, and they're not sure if it's okay to ask for help. One of the most powerful things that parents can do is to start a conversation with their children about mental health, to let them know it's okay if you struggle. That doesn't mean that you're broken in some way, and you're certainly not the only one.
Has your child seemed more anxious or distracted? What have you said or talked about? How have those conversations gone? 800-642-1234. Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health Director Linda Hall with us for about 7 more minutes. Let's go to Kevin in Janesville. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Two things actually came up. As a public school teacher, I am really kind of hesitant to add anything more to the plate of the public school teacher right now. We are dealing with an awful lot in the classrooms as kids are struggling with all of these issues. Sometimes it seems like parents are abdicating a little of their own parental responsibility. But my main question is, do the data show any link between social media use and mental health issues? I'll take my response off the air.
Kevin, thank you so much. Linda.
We do not quote any data related to that in our report. Obviously, there is a good deal of concern about that. We looked at this issue a year before last, and we really found that we think it's important to think about healthy screen use. And so there's a lot of negative things that kids can be exposed to. In fact, we had a hearing with youth and young adults this in 2021, and they were telling us that they felt that they were exposed to too many inappropriate things and harmful information early in their lives, and that the adults around them, including their parents, had no idea of what they were seeing. And they were telling us that they felt that there need to be some guidelines for younger kids on how to use screen time. So we know that's an issue. When we looked at this issue before, healthy use of screen time, you can find a fact sheet for it on our website. We found that when families have a plan around screen time, that it makes a difference. And we found that kids are not getting enough sleep, in part because of screen time. So that's important because we need kids to get their sleep. That's important for brain development. And so I do believe that there's national data that show that excessive use of media can lead to depression. And so that it is important to limit that screen time and try to have it be for positive things. Like if it has to be for school, it's for school. If it helps kids to connect positively to other kids, that's important because we've seen, especially during the pandemic, that kids feel less connected. And when they're not connected, that leads to depression and risky behavior. So it's something to watch. And just in terms of, I'm glad that Kevin brought up teachers. it is really, teachers are struggling with a lot. They've got so much on their plates. And, you know, Wisconsin has invested more in school counselors and psychologists. And we've seen the numbers increase, but there just are not enough of them to really address all of the issues that kids are presenting for us and all the support that they need at school.
Just a notable point I want to add here about your data. A lot of the data that your agency uses in the annual report, this is from before the pandemic started. What is the data that you bring in to this report, and why does it take so long for this information that is happening in the pandemic to become available to use for your data?
Well, you're right, Kate. A lot of the data is, almost all of it is pre-pandemic data. So 2018 and 2019, a lot of it. What we try to do with our report is to provide data that allow us to look at what's the current situation in Wisconsin and what was it a few years ago. We generally look at a five-year period. So what is it now? Compare ourselves to where we were 5 years ago. And then we get so many questions about how Wisconsin is doing compared to other states. We want to be able to compare Wisconsin to the national average and the national data. To get that national data takes a longer time. Mm-hmm. Inventories are not done every year. Sometimes they vary. The amount of data varies from year to year. So we have kind of a 1 to 2 year lag on that. So what we did in this report because we knew people were going to be so interested in how is the pandemic affecting kids, we, in our child demographics pages, we provided what we could in terms of how the picture has changed because of the pandemic. And just to summarize, we'll say that what was happening with kids before the pandemic, the trends we were seeing there, just seem to be exaggerated by the pandemic. And that's that trend of increased anxiety and depression and lack of connectedness.
And on that word connectedness, I want to zoom in on one possible solution that you really want people to spend time on, inspiring social connectedness among youth. What is going on there?
Yes, that's right, Kate. We have been looking at the data for a couple of years, looking at what we see as the primary mental health issues affecting kids at different points along the lifespan. And we said, what's the one thing we could ask everybody to work on that would make a difference? And the data and our network are telling us that it's social connectedness of kids. And so that is going to be our focus for this year. We are going to be rolling out more information on this and giving people a better idea of what they can do in their community to increase the social connectedness of youth so that we can have them feeling better and have a brighter future.
Linda, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having us on this important issue, and we hope to be able to talk with you again.
Linda Hall, Director of the State Office of Children's Mental Health. We have a link to the 2021 annual report at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, we'll hit the bricks, the Lego bricks, that is, with two master builders from the La Crosse area who have found some fame with their Lego building. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.